Our special guest on the Ray Carr Show is Madeline Baccaro, the book, In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. We're going to get into what Yoko is all about, and we're going to talk about did she or did she not break up the Beatles, and things about Yoko you don't know. So let's welcome Madeline Baccaro. In Your Mind refers to Yoko Ono's art. All of her works are completed in the mind of the imagination of the viewer. That's basically what this book is about.
Yes, it is.
And why did you write the book? I mean, what was the purpose of writing the book for you?
I wanted to get Yoko's true story out into the world because there's been so many lies written about her, deliberately to sell newspapers. And I wouldn't mind if she was an evil person or if some of it or any of it was true, but none of it. It's just the opposite of what she is. She's very warm and caring, loving, nourishing. She saved John. You know, people complain that, you know, she took him on a different path or whatever, broke up the band. But if it wasn't for her, we do not know what the state of his well-being would have been.
Well, they met in November 1966 in London, and they didn't start dating until 18 months after that. And John was still married, and Yoko was still married to somebody else. But at that moment when they first met, there had to be sparks that must have been flying inside of them.
Oh, yes, there were sparks, but they were also very intimidated and apprehensive about getting together. That's why it didn't happen for 18 months. I mean, she was doing her own work. She had just gotten separated from her second husband, and she didn't want a relationship tying her down. And she also saw what kind of celebrity he had, and she was very wary about getting involved in that.
Yeah, John, it seemed like John was always looking for something he didn't have. And, you know, with his mother, Julia, and there was gaps within him that he was voiding.
They had the same gaps. In childhood, yeah. They were both born during wartime. She had parental issues as well, although they were present and there in the home. Well, father wasn't. He was away until she was almost 3 years old. She had never met her father. And her mother was a socialite, and she was left with servants to raise her. And she just had these older women, you know, preparing her meals and staring at her while she ate, and had no friends of her own of her age. And she was very, very lonely. So they both gravitated towards each other. They fulfilled everything that each other needed.
Yeah. And describe your long relationship with Yoko that gave you this incredibly unique perspective on which you're able to write the book.
Well, I had liked her since I was a child, and I began writing to her. And in the 80s, a friend of mine convinced me to go with her to the Dakota and see Yoko. She said, you know, Yoko really needs to meet you at this point, you know, someone who really cares and loves her. You know, it's a terrible time for Yoko. John was gone, and she was not doing that great. So I said, okay. So we went there on her birthday, and I met her and gave her a present, and she realized I was the one that had been writing these letters to her and understanding all of her music and her meanings, and she was so thrilled to talk about it all with me because nobody really, they were all trying to get John's music from her, and, you know, she was putting it out slowly, but everybody was just interested in John, and she was really happy to talk about her own work, and she invited me to all her exhibitions and even exhibitions of John's work that she was putting out at the time, and, you know, concerts backstage. And I just really got a lot of insight from, you know, being with her.
How much, if you had to describe Yoko Ono in essence to somebody who just knows her name and not knows her anything about her, how would you describe her?
She's very special. You can really see why John loves her when you meet her. There's just a warmth about her. She's very intuitive, and she's very caring about your own feelings. And she's brilliant, really brilliant. And she observes things in a very unique way. She sees things that are kind of like seeing a negative space. Like when you're looking, she had an exhibition called Half a Wind Show, and everything was in this white room, all painted white, and every object was cut in half. But we come to the exhibition and we're looking at the half that's right in front of us. But what she's presenting is the half that isn't there. She always has this thing about what's invisible and what's important, like air. It's the most important thing to our lives and existence, yet you can't see it. Or the wind. The wind is in a lot of her works. And she's just very esoteric and poetic in a way. But she's also very funny. She's got a lot of humor, and she uses kind of like a Zen reference to her work, where there's a kind of slyness to it, and even a riddle she presents sometimes.
John and Yoko recorded some experimental albums, Life with the Lions, Two Virgins, and others. And Yoko did a lot of screaming on those records, which at the time I didn't understand. But that comes from the pain that she suffered as a child. Is that correct?
Well, it's not her own. Well, she was suffering, but the way that happened was, you know, like people see something and they get obsessed with it over their lifetime. Like you could see someone in a wheelchair and someone actually breaks their leg to be in a wheelchair because they got something clicked in their mind about that instance. But she was told not to go near the servants' quarters, but she did one day when she was very young, and she heard these teenage girls talking about one of their aunts who had given birth, and they said this woman was screaming, and they were imitating how she sounded. And in Japanese society, women were especially meant to be seen and not heard, like super quiet.
Yeah.
And for her to hear that something like that was actually happening to every woman in the world, you know, it really made an impact on her. And it was her means of expression in a lot of her songs. Not all of them. Most people don't know. She has beautiful ballads and always had amazing musicians on her records. And most of it is absolutely beautiful.
What are some of the works that she's most proud of?
I don't think she would single any one of them out. I mean, it's all one thing to her, the music, the art, the films, the performance, the events. It's all one organic, you know, work. And the most important thing is the message of peace, the women's rights, the feminism that she's been perpetuating through her life. And that's the most important thing is the result that she's going to get from you, or the reaction or the interaction. That's what her art's all about. That's why it's unfinished, and that's why it's in your mind.
Madeline Beccaro, a special guest. Madeline, tell me a little bit about performance art, and let's explain what that is in some of Yoko Ono's specific pieces, or her pieces.
Well, I think her most meaningful one is cut piece. She would sit on a stage with a pair of scissors and wearing her best item of clothing at the time when she didn't really have a lot of money. She just made sure that she wore something, you know, that was meaningful or valuable, and offered herself and the clothing up to the public to come and cut away. And what it was based on was she had read the story of Buddha, you know, just being so giving and giving up everything, like his health, his clothing, even his own flesh and his family, just giving. And that's what her life was all about, is just giving a message, giving of herself. And that's what cut piece was. And it was a little dangerous because you didn't know, you know, once a guy came up and he held the scissors over her head as if he was going to stab her in jest, you know. And nowadays, if anybody did a thing like that, they'd be really in danger.
Right.
Did she ever get the a wrong reaction where she went into a performance art piece thinking that she was going to get this reaction, but she didn't? She got the opposite. Did that ever happen?
Not really. People engage with it. You know, whether they understood it or not, some people just thought of it as fun or silly or something they could just do. She had she called a piece fly, and he just climbed to the top of this ladder and jump off, and people just did it and participated. And of course, the famous one that John Lennon, when he first met her, it was a ceiling painting. And that was a ladder you climbed to the top. And on the ceiling was a canvas with a very, very tiny letters written in the center. And you put this magnifying glass and looked, and it said the word yes. And that's what inspired John, the positivity of that message. And just that this woman was doing something so refreshing and different in the art world.
Yoko came to New York City, if I'm not mistaken, around September 1952, and she went to Sarah Lawrence College. And what a different lifestyle the U.S. had, you know, opposed to Japan. So, I mean, what was that like at that time leading up to when she met John, which would have been about 14 years later?
Well, that was, she moved here with her parents. They had moved because her father had a banking job here. And she attended Sarah Lawrence, and she wasn't finding anything that she was interested in. And then her professor recommended that she see these people in New York, the avant-garde artists who were creating some strange music and events and happenings, and like John Cage or Lamont Young, and even Toshi Itanagi, who ended up becoming her first husband. He's a Japanese composer. And she ended up moving to the city and working with them, and also starting a concert series in a loft of her own that she invited all these artists to perform, because there was nowhere in Manhattan to host these artists at the time. And they did all their, some of them were just event performers, some of them were musicians, and they all got to do their thing at her loft. And that's a famous series now, and it's, people do the Meltdown Festival now and curate artists to perform, but that was kind of the first instance of that happening.
How well did her and John Cage work together?
Oh, very well. They totally understood each other. They discussed vocalizing in the, I think it was in the 70s, there's this discussion on YouTube. And they're talking about different vocalizations, but he was more about noise and silence. You know, he has that famous piece 433, yeah, which is ominous noise and silence. And they were very, very much on the same wavelength.
Did she ever feel that some of her projects were too out there for most people to wrap their minds around?
Definitely. She was way ahead of her time. I mean, some of these things now would be completely understood. But, you know, everybody in the art world, even Andy Warhol, you know, he was laughed at first. And these are the people that seem to be having the longest legacy, people who are just so innovative.
Yeah, she's very creative, and just in ways that, you know, when you think of the Beatles and John Lennon, you think of Yoko, and she's like, as a kid growing up loving the Beatles, I didn't quite understand what her role was, and thinking that she broke up the Beatles, but of course this isn't true at all.
No, it's not. In fact, there's a quote from her saying that, you know, when John told her he was going to leave the band, she had a wave of fear rush over her, because she thought, well, what's going to preoccupy him now? I need to do my own work, you know, like, because at the time he had her with him in the studio constantly, and she was obviously bored, and she's, you know, making notes or thinking about what her next project was going to be. And she had never collaborated with anyone before, and all she was thinking about was her own work. But he turned to her and he said, well, now it's just you and me. And imagine the pressure. But they were just able to hit the ground running, and they started doing their events together with, like, the Bed In and the Acorn event and everything, all the Work for Peace. And they were just so compatible in that way.
Yeah, because it seemed like, as I got, you know, I'm older now, I look back on things, the Beatles were growing apart from each other, because they were with each other for so long as adolescents growing into young adults that they wanted to expand and do their own thing, because that's normally what somebody would just, you were with somebody for so long, Now you just want to branch out and try new things. And I think really that's what it was. You know, Paul was with Linda, and, you know, George and Ringo were doing other things. And John and Yoko were married, I believe it was March 20th, 1969 in Gibraltar, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was a combination of things. There was a lot of legal pressures on them. I think that's what really broke them apart. You know, just the legal wrangling and disagreements. And it was a mess. And she just happened to be there. And Linda was there, too, but nobody blames her. You know, and she formed a band with Paul. She encouraged him to form Wings, just like, because he was very depressed when the Beatles split. And John, you know, didn't know what he was going to do. And Yoko said, well, form Plastic Ono Band. So they were kind of on parallel paths.
Yeah, certainly with much more of an edge on the Plastic Ono Band side of things. Paul was far more pop-oriented. And I think John really just kept driving home a message, whatever he was feeling at the time. And there was a song that Yoko recorded on a Plastic Ono Band album that was released in 1970 called Why. That was a powerful song that she did.
That was incredible. Yeah, she had Ringo, and it was during the recording of John's solo album, and he had Ringo and Klaus Vorm in there, and they did a big jam session with Yoko, and that ended up becoming her first solo album, which was wild. And their son Sean always says, you know, she goes from avant-garde music, not even being into rock and roll, to inventing punk rock on that album.
Yeah, that's true. Explain to me and our audience Fluxus, the international community of artists. You know, clear that one up for me a little bit.
Okay, so that was, there's this man, George McCunis, and he founded this, art cooperative, pretty much, of artists who wanted to just take art off of the wall and into the streets or into a whole different realm. And everything was involved. There were artists who made objects and work to participate in, and also events. So, and there was also musicians. So Yoko was really close with George. And even though she's labeled amongst the Fluxus group, you know, she's always been on the outside. You know, the avant-garde, you know, they embraced her when she was not famous, but when she started getting notoriety, they kind of said, oh, she's sold out. And, you know, the Fluxus group were not really doing exactly what she was doing, but she was amongst all of them, and she did work with all of them.
As the John and Yoko's relationship moved through the 1970s, I know they had a separation period, and he went off to California with Mai Peng. And can you explain what happened with that and how they eventually got back together again?
Well, first of all, they had the deepest love story of anyone that I've ever heard of in history. I mean, the most beautiful songs that both of them have ever written are about each other. They were just so close. They gave up everything for each other. They totally understood each other. And they were together 24/7. But that became stifling because what spurred the separation was that John went into a downward spiral. They had put out that album sometime in New York City, and they were associating with the radical leftists, which were Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and all those people who were very demonstrative. And it wasn't a good association for them because John had a previous bust for pot in London, and Yoko was arrested as well, and he kind of admitted to it just to save Yoko from being deported, and this followed him and plagued him through his whole life. And because of his association with these political people, and Nixon winning the election and a whole host of other things, the FBI began following them and made them paranoid, and everything was just coming to a head. And John ended up having a one-night stand, and this broke the camel's back. And Yoko said, look, you know, we've got to separate, whether we get back together or not, just separate. And she sent him, she was going to L.A. to record or to see, you meet up with all these other people. One of them was Paul and Harry Nilsson and Al Cooper and all these people who were notorious drinkers. And but she sent him out there with May Pang, who was their assistant. This wasn't just some random woman he picked to have an affair with. I mean, she sent May with him and said, look, you know, watch over him, make sure he's okay. And she knew they would probably have an affair, but she figured better with her than anyone stranger. And so they did fall in love, and they did have a nice relationship, and she took care of him out there as much as she could because he was just inconsolable. He missed Yoko. He wanted to come back to her, but she wouldn't take him back. She just had to ride it out and see what would happen. And then the way they reunited was, most people don't know this, and it's in my book. It's actually a whole page of a quote from Paul McCartney saying, you know, him and Linda visited Yoko at the Dakota, and he said, look, what's going on? You're not together. Is there anything I can do? And she said, well, the only way I'll take him back is if he courts me and we start over and we date from scratch. And Paul said, okay, well, it's okay if I go out and talk to him. And he said the funniest things. He said, you know, I could say she loves you and she sends all my loving to you. You sing Beatles songs. And she said, yeah, okay. And he told John her conditions and he said, okay, I'm going to do that. And he won her back and they moved in together again. And 10 months later, their son Sean was born. Yeah. And it was undeniable they would reunite.
Well, then they were later on, of course, and probably in 1979, they started recording Double Fantasy. And that tragic night, December 8th, 1980, was a Monday night. I'll never forget that night. Has she confided in you some things that, you know, looking back on that, have she shared some thoughts with you on that night?
You know, she shared thoughts with the world on that night. Specifically, her and I never really talked about that. I didn't want to dredge that up. We always talked about her music and positive things, whatever she was working on at the time. But this woman was so honest. John as well. All they did was bare their soul, tell truth to everyone. Yet their stories got twisted and misunderstood. And even her putting John's bloody glasses on the album cover of her album that she released 6 months after his death called Season of Glass, people gave her hell for that. But she, the way she saw it was that, you know, I saw my husband fall in front of me in a pool of his blood. And this is only a mild representation, a minuscule bit of what I saw. And she just wanted to show that to the world. And she thought that John would have wanted that as well.
Yeah, and she recorded, I believe she was in the middle of recording Walking on Thin Ice, and, you know, that was, released a little bit after that. And
that's right.
Yeah, I remember that very well on Geffen Records. That was an unbelievable time. I know we can't change the way things turned out, but if John had not been shot, what do you think John would have done? What do you think John and Yoko would have created in the early 80s?
Well, they were planning a tour for Double Fantasy, and they were going to go to places they'd never been, because now he finally got his green card after all the fighting with the FBI and the big lawsuit that they won. And he was now free to travel. He was stuck in America, because if he left, he couldn't get back in.
Right.
So they started spending summers in Japan with Sean and introducing him to Yoko's family, and that was a beautiful time for them. Every summer, over 4 or 5 summers that he had there. And then they were going to do this world tour, and it was going to be called the Yes Tour, because everything Yoko said was coming from Yes. And they were planning it. They had, you know, really thought it out. They were going to play in Iceland and Japan and all these different places they'd never been before. But then it happened.
Iceland. Wow. Reykjavik is a beautiful city in Iceland, and I'm sure that would be one heck of a concert. I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, and now it's the home of Imagine Peace Tower, the Tower of Light that Yoko created in John's memory.
We're speaking with Madeline Beccaro. The book is In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. You know, the one thing I haven't touched on, Madeline, is the children. We mentioned Sean briefly, but let's talk about her children and Julian. I don't know how do the children play into this?
She has a daughter. Her first child, only child, is Kyoko, and that was with her second husband. And she was the one that was the husband disappeared with the child.
Right.
And there was many reasons for that. You know, one thing was he had joined a religious cult, and another thing was that he felt that John, or maybe he was jealous that the child was very close with John. I mean, you see her at the bed in with them, and the fact that John and Yoko were doing drugs, and he had raised the child as well, so they were very close. And he just, you know, disappeared with her. And later on, you know, of course, everybody has regrets. He regrets that he did it. He didn't realize how much Yoko was suffering about the whole thing. And then the other child, his grandchildren, Yoko has two children. And Julian, you know, Julian is John's son, and everybody, you know, makes it like there was a big deal between him and Yoko. But you know what? I haven't seen the paperwork, let's say. You know, they had some trouble, I understand. But Sean and Julian are very close, and it's all resolved. And, you know, Yoko attended Julian's concerts. You know, they're fine now.
That's good. That's good. You know, time heals all wounds in most cases.
That's great.
Yeah.
So by meeting and knowing Yoko Ono, you're obviously a better person. But what else has Yoko taught you that helps you in your daily life?
Just to be totally positive, and you know, despite the fact that none of your dreams may come true, just the hope and the wishing, and that you do have an inner power. That's what she's trying to bring out. She's trying to enlighten us to that, and also to look for the truth in everything. Tell the truth, write the truth, live the truth. You know, that's the way to be. And with all the hatred and everything that's come at her, she has survived it. She called it like acupuncture, all these little jabs and stabs that she received all her life. You know, she turned it into a healing. And she just has this lightness about her, and she's just wonderful.
Madeline Beccaro, our special guest. Madeline, let's tell the audience where they can get your book, In Your Mind.
Okay, so overseas, it's best to probably get it on Amazon, because the shipping can be crazy from the USA. But the hardcover version, which has the option of being signed, is only available at conceptualbooks.com.
And are you going to be giving any talks around the country about this?
Some things are coming up. Her birthday is coming up on February 18th, her 90th. So I'm scheduling a lot of things, starting in New York mostly. And actually, I want to mention a website for the book, which is inyourmindbook.com. And there's everything there. The reviews, which have been amazing, from her colleagues, from the greatest people, are saying the greatest things about it. And you can also see other interviews I've done and read all about it.
The first time that you met Yoko, what was that interaction like?
It was magical. She was just really warm and loving and sweet, and we just felt like we knew each other for 1,000 years. Just fell into step, and it was a beautiful, beautiful experience.
Growing up for you, tell me, let's share with the audience a little bit about, like, what was life growing up for you?
Well, I was an only child, which is, you know, is lonely as well. I lived in the suburbs on Long Island, pretty comfortable, but I always had a yearning for the city and for the art scene and the culture. And that's why I was drawn to her and her work. And she opened my eyes to all the culture that was happening at the time. And it was amazing. Like, even the book, it illuminates the wonderful 60s and 70s, like how incredible those times were and how much was packed into those years. You know, how much important history happened, and, you know, Woodstock, the Manson murders, just the times they were living in and producing all this great work. So I was just drawn to all of that.
John recorded Imagine, which came out in 1971. What was the impetus of that song?
It was just a simple message, you know, look, we're all the same, we're all equal, peace and love, you know. He says he got in trouble, of course, years later after his passing, a church started complaining about the line about Imagine No Religion. But he didn't mean that you can't believe in what you want to believe in. He just meant no dividing lines, no countries, no borders, no, you know, everything is free. He just meant it as, you know, we're all together in this.
Was there any, you know, this is something I honestly don't know the answer to. Was there anything that Yoko really liked musically about the Beatles? Was there songs that she really liked that they did?
Well, it's funny because she did mention one time that she really liked The Fool on the Hill, which is a Paul song.
Right. That's right.
And yeah, and she loved it all. She really loved it. And Strawberry Fields, she said that it was played for her at a party in France. And I'm going to try to find the quote about the song. Oh, I got to find it. So she said, that was the first John Lennon song that I encountered. And there's a party at an art magazine editor's house. And he said, listen to this. When a pop song comes to this point, what do you think? And she said, oh, you know, there were some dissonant sounds, and I thought it was pretty good for a pop song. I thought it was cute, some cute stuff, because I was making songs with all dissonant sounds, and it impressed me. I was surprised that a pop song could be that way. And there's a lot of connections about that song, because John, you know, had that, he lived near the actual Strawberry Fields, which was an orphanage. And he would always tell her that his Aunt Mimi would always say when he was, you know, misbehaving, you know, you can go over there, John, we'll put you in there. And so that to him was connected with this strange kind of fear and the love for the children that were there, and that he was in a better position. And then, of course, she created Strawberry Fields in Central Park,
right,
in his name, where people gather to, you know, remember him.
Yeah, the line in here, living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. I mean, you know, you hear those words, but, you know, when you really think about it, you know, Yoko and John, and it really takes on a new meaning.
Mm-hmm. And the line, no one I think is in my tree, it must be high or low. That line used to be, before he crossed out the words, it said, no one is on my wavelength, it must be high or low. And that's when he was actually looking for someone like Yoko. So he always looks back on that and says, yes, that was what I was looking for.
Madeline Beccaro, thank you so much for being on the Ray Carr Show. I'd like to have you back on again. And it was really wonderful speaking about a topic that, you know, very interesting person, but there's so many layers. Like Yoko, it's like an onion. Every time you pull up a layer of it, you learn so much more about who she really is.
There's so much that people don't know. So it goes way beyond. And everything is fascinating about her life, her ancestry, even her childhood. And after John, there's so many things.
Is there anything you can leave us with, something we haven't covered here in the interview, that about Yoko that most people just wouldn't know?
Well, basically, she came from wealth, but she abandoned it, and then she built it up again. She managed John's estate, and she built it up, but none of that ever meant much to her, because money to her is a concept, and everything we do, our values are completely misplaced, and that's what she's trying to teach us. You know, we value gold more than water. I mean, what use is gold to us if we want to survive? And she just sees things in a very clear way, and there's a lot of her wisdom in the book. On every page, there's at least two or three quotes from her, and they're all astounding.
Wow, very fascinating stuff. You did a wonderful job with the book, and thank you for sharing a lot of that with me.
Thank you, Ray.